Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
Legends, the greatest social casino experience has arrived at Legends.com. With thousands of the best free-to-play casino-style games, chances to earn millions of bonus coins and win real money. Legends is revolutionizing the Vegas experience wherever you are. If you love winning, then you'll love playing at Legends.com. Legends is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Play responsibly. Visit Legends.com for more information. Legends with a Z.com is legendary fun.
I'm Emma Kenny. Welcome to Bang to Rights, the deep dive crime podcast, which takes you through some of the most heinous crimes the world has ever seen. Imagine waking up to flames billowing from a house on your street. You immediately call emergency services. You get them out to their house. You're hoping and praying that the family who live there are going to be all right, but they aren't. Every single member of that family are dead. And on first look, you imagine, well, that's a terrible tragedy, a house fire that's ravaged the home, only to find out later on that the entire family had been massacred, literally massacred. That's exactly what happened in the murders that I'm going to cover today, the Clydach murders. So let's go through exactly what happened. 34-year-old Amanda Power, she was actually known better as Mandy. She lived in a semi-detached house at 9 Kelvin Road in Clydach. It's a small, very tight-knit community in West Glamorgan. She lived there with her two daughters. She had Katie, who was aged 10, and she had Emily, who was aged 8. She also lived with a terminally ill bedridden mother. She was 80 years of age, Doris Dawson. Katie and Emily's father didn't actually live at the address with them. The marriage had broken down. And even though Michael Power still had a relationship with his kids, the reality was that they were separated. And that had dawned a new opportunity for Mandy. She was happier than ever. She was really enjoying life. And she had, to some degree, I would say, become a sexual adventurer. So she'd had quite a string of boyfriends, but she was loving life, genuinely. It was one of those scenarios where people looking in could see that even though she'd been through some transitions in her personal life, it was really positive. And then we get to Sunday, the 27th of June, 1999. Emergency services are called. It's at 4:27 a.m. that they get that call because the neighbours have reported that there is a really serious fire at Mandy Power's home. The firefighters arrived quite quickly, and very quickly they're able to establish that it wasn't just one fire that had broken out. We're not talking about an electric fault that's just caused this horrendous scenario to unfold. They established that several fires have been started within the property. So one of them in particular was very fierce. That was in the kitchen. And what they suspected was that that fire had been started after the other fires that had been set off upstairs. But that's because those ones upstairs hadn't actually properly taken hold. So the person had needed to make sure that the house burnt down, clearly trying to cover up what they'd done. Because in the property, the firefighters, first of all, make a really grim discovery because they find the body of Mandy. They find her two really young daughters. Remember, these are children that they're finding, and also her elderly bedridden mother, all of them dead. At first glance, they suspect that this is just a horrendous fire, maybe arson. But as they get closer and start looking at the bodies, they can tell it's immediately evident that they had not burned to death. It hadn't been smoke inhalation that had killed them. They'd all suffered the most catastrophic injuries to their heads. And these were sustained, brutal injuries for all of the individuals who'd been murdered. It was later down the line described as a massacre carried out in an orgy of violence. That just indicates how gruesome that scene was. Each of the victims' skulls had been crushed, and this was after they'd first been throttled. So Mandy was struck at least 38 times, and they suspected that she'd first been attacked in her bedroom. The attack had then continued that had occurred in her mother's room. Meanwhile, Doris's body had been set alight after she was killed. Bear in mind, this is an old and vulnerable, terminally ill old lady. Then they found 10-year-old Katie's body that was found on the landing. And then little 8-year-old Emily's body was found in her bedroom, and she was still in a cowering position. That just chills me to the bone, the fact that that little girl was in that cowering position, knowing what was coming. They also found the really heavily bloodstained murder weapon that was abandoned on the landing, and that was a 1.3 metre long, 2 centimetre diameter black fiberglass pole, and it had been coated in plastic. It weighed around a kilogram, and that had actually been left, ironically, that murder weapon that was used had been left at the property by the previous tenants. The kids had used it as a kind of toy. They liked to twirl it like a baton. So essentially that was used against them. And the reason they believed that the murderer got that weapon was because Katie had tried to potentially defend her mum from the initial attack using that pole. But then awfully it had been taken off her and then used to kill them all. When they did the analysis of the blood and hair on the weapon, they were able to figure out that it seemed that Doris was probably the first killed and then that Katie was the last killed. They also found a white bloodstained sports sock, and they do believe that that sock had been worn as something to grip onto the murder weapon but also protect from leaving fingerprints, so that they put it on the hand to do that. Police also found a gold chain that was on the floor at the murder scene, and it was a 9-carat gold beveled curb-linked chain, and the hallmark was 1989. They couldn't find the jump ring and fastener for it, but the actual necklace itself was just caked in Mandy's blood. So they anticipated, looking at that, that potentially the person who had attacked them, Mandy, had ripped it from the killer's neck. And that down the line will prove to be a vital piece of evidence. Then the pathologist who goes to the scene obviously has to look at the bodies and decide exactly what's played out. They find a really disturbing addition to this, because Mandy had been sexually assaulted, and they believe that she was sexually assaulted after her death. They found a vibrator that was in her vagina. So they feel that she'd been sexually violated after she'd been murdered. And it was also established that the killer had done some very, very, very strange things. I mean, a number of incredibly strange acts, bearing in mind that this person has come into that home and bludgeoned to death children, an elderly lady, and Mandy, and violated Mandy. And to some degree, you can kind of think about the mindset of somebody who would go around doing that, right? Maybe they'd be panicking. You know, this is, as was noted, a massacre. Surely they're going to want to get away. But that's not how they acted at all. In fact, instead of fleeing the scene, they take Mandy's body to the bathroom and they wash it. Also, they wash themselves of the blood that they were no doubt covered in, because traces of blood were found on the bathroom wall, on a bar of soap, on the shower curtain, and also on the shower control unit, because there was blood everywhere. But then the killer had literally spent hours just ransacking the drawers and checking videos. So they spent ages looking through all of the belongings. And then finally, they'd set fire through all areas of the house, you know, just trying to make sure that it took hold. They believed that the first fire had been started around 12:30 to 1 a.m., but it just hadn't managed to catch. And then the second fire had been started a few hours later. So it was clearly at that point an attempt to just destroy the evidence. But firefighters had fortunately managed to extinguish the flames in time so that they were able to kind of find this evidence, the little bits that remained at least. Of course, straight away, murder investigation is launched. The police and the profilers, they anticipated that it's likely Mandy knew her attacker because there was no sign whatsoever of a forced entry into the property. So it seemed that it had to be one of two things. Either the killer had been let in and allowed into the home, or that killer had a key. Also, the belief was that it was Mandy who was the actual target because she was the one who was sexually assaulted. So it sounds horrible to say, but the children and her mother were just, for the killer, some kind of collateral damage. They wanted to attack Mandy, but these others that were involved because they happened to be present. But like I said, she was the one that they wanted. As far as the profiles were concerned, Mandy was definitely the intended victim. And when you think about what I've described regarding the actual killings, the extent of violence, you can't do anything but assume that there was a great deal of anger behind that motivation. I mean, the injuries that were inflicted on every single one of the victims, it way exceeded what was necessary to have killed them. The overkill was enormous because it was constant rain down blows. I mean, the terror that would have been going through those little girls' minds, the shock, the confusion, everything that they know becoming completely foreign, and this human being, this human predator, just catastrophically attacking them and the mother, the grandma, all of those things happening in instance without any control over what they could change about that situation. They were helpless, absolutely helpless. And think about that. The fact that this individual probably killed one, then another, then another. So they're watching, those little girls are watching at some point somebody that they love being hurt, or they are themselves the person being hurt. The investigation was a really vast undertaking because this is a mass murder. That's what we're talking about. We're talking about mass murder. So they go about taking lots and lots of statements. They had about 4,500 statements that were taken, and they had about 4,000 exhibits that they collated. It's actually the biggest investigation that was ever undertaken by South Wales Police. So they had 50 detectives who were working on that case for the next 2 years, and it cost £6 million. So that size of an investigation, that cost of an investigation, you're absolutely going to want to bring somebody to justice, aren't you? Because there's a massive investment there. It gets to the 30th of July 1999, and that's when Mandy, her mother and her two daughters were actually buried in Clydach. So hundreds of people lined the streets for the funeral. Genuinely, this crime still impacts that community. It just didn't make sense to people. It still doesn't make sense to people. I just want to shout out BetterHelp, who is my sponsor today. I'm a therapist. I spent 20 years working in the field. And the reality is, I think that therapy is amazing. And BetterHelp is bringing it into your homes all over the world. BetterHelp Online Therapy assesses your needs and can match you with your own licensed professional therapist in less than 48 hours. It's not a crisis line. It's not self-help. It's professional therapy done securely online. And it is available to people worldwide. You can log into your account anytime. You can send a message to your therapist. You can schedule weekly video or phone sessions so you don't have to be on camera if you don't want to. And getting therapy every week is as easy as a few clicks away on your laptop or phone. And in therapy, you know it can take a few tries to find the right fit for you. So BetterHelp makes it easy and free to change therapists, you know, if you don't feel that they're the right therapist for you. It's more affordable than traditional online therapy, which is great, and financial aid is available. BetterHelp is an amazing way to invest in yourself. In fact, so many people have been using BetterHelp that they're actually recruiting additional therapists in all 50 states in the US. And they have a special offer for you guys, my true crime viewers. Get 10% off your first month at betterhelp.com/bang. That's 10% off your first month of online therapy at betterhelp.com/bang. One of the first officers who arrived at this horrendous scene on the night of the murders, and who was also the most senior officer, was Acting Inspector Stuart Lewis. Stuart Lewis, he had a twin brother, Stephen. Well, Stephen was also a police officer. He was rank of sergeant. And Stephen's wife, Alison, she had been a police officer. So just bear this in mind. But she'd basically been pensioned off for psychological reasons. Apparently, she found a man who'd gassed himself in his car and it had provoked a nervous breakdown. She ended up being put on Prozac. And in spite of the fact that she obviously had these issues that were very challenging for her, and I understand that kind of post-trauma is awful, she did actually manage to go on to be selected for the women's national Welsh rugby team. Also, she achieved a black belt in karate. So she was an individual that potentially managed her mental health through doing things like sport. So this is a family who are very much involved in the policing world. Bizarrely though, what transpires is that the police become aware that Alison had been having an affair with Mandy. So Alison and Mandy had met 8 months earlier, and it had been Mandy's first lesbian relationship. As I said, Mandy was going on some sexual adventures, and it seems that Alison and her had got together and had this pretty intense relationship. Now, the news of this horrific murders just spread throughout this very close-knit community. And when Alison hears about the fact that Mandy's been murdered, she hears from one of her neighbours, she just rushes to the house. And allegedly, after that, she went into an incredibly deep shock. She started to act like she was speaking to Mandy. She was holding her arms out as though she was with Mandy. She started hyperventilating. And it wasn't long after this that she tried to kill herself at home. She wandered upstairs and she was about to jump out of her bedroom window. That's when her husband and a friend actually hear her shout that she wants to be with Mandy. Now, God's grace intervene, they hear it, and they manage to actually catch her before she jumps. She then gets admitted to a psychiatric ward, and she actually had to stay there for some time. Now, Alison, later down the line, is interviewed by police because she's been in a relationship with Mandy, and they want to check out what this relationship was like. Ultimately, when you are in a relationship with somebody and they end up murdered, you are going to be a potential suspect. So they ask her, are you in a relationship with Mandy? And she confirmed that that was true. They'd been having an affair. She even stated that Mandy had gone to her house for a barbecue the night before the murders. That was on the 25th of June, 1999. And after Alison's husband, Stephen, had gone to bed, Alison and Mandy had had sex downstairs. In fact, Mandy had apparently brought a strap-on dildo with her, so that was going on without a doubt, and she confirms this. Now, the police at that point think to themselves, okay, so Alison isn't denying that she's having this relationship. She's being forthcoming with the information that she's given us, but she's married. So that's not going to potentially go down very well with the husband. So the police start suspecting that Stephen had potentially found out about the affair and then just lost it, killed Mandy in a jealous rage. But in spite of this being a potential suspicion, Alison is absolutely adamant it's not true. In fact, she says he only finds out about the affair after the murders. In fact, the day after the murders. Because obviously her behaviour is demonstrative, because she's in complete mourning about the loss of Mandy. Also, various witnesses confirmed that that was the case, that he'd only found out the day after the murders. But there was one witness that claimed otherwise. This witness said that she had actually seen Stephen stood outside Mandy's house and he was threatening her.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen, brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
Essentially, he said, leave my wife alone or I'll kill you. So that's pretty strong words. But like I said, there's only one person who said that. Another potential suspicion that they had about who might have killed her was that Alison could have been the killer. First of all, Alison was apparently known to be a very jealous person. She was prone, apparently, to violent outbursts. And also, think about her martial arts training. She was trained in the use of blunt force instruments. And to be fair, when they were looking at the killings themselves, one of the things that was brought forward was that it felt that there had been a fair degree of expertise in the killings because every single strike appeared to have impacted the victims. None of the furniture, none of the walls had been damaged. Also, Alison's DNA was the only DNA profile that was recovered from the murder scene. And it was also found in Mandy's vagina and on her thighs. So again, that, as far as the police is concerned, connects Alison to the potential crime scene. Now, Stephen and Alison, they deny the allegations altogether. Stephen says he was home with Alison on the night of the killings. Alison confirms this. He actually stated that he was beside her in bed all night. And Alison has an explanation for the fact that the DNA is present because she said they had sex several times the day before. That's why it's present. Now, Stephen's brother, Stuart, well, he also falls under suspicion because the police feel that he dealt very unprofessionally with the situation the night that he arrived at the scene. Bear in mind, he was a senior officer that night, but it transpires he literally stayed at the crime scene for less than 10 minutes. And after being advised that the victims had been attacked, they hadn't died in the fire, he fails to notify the control room of a suspected mass murder. So instead of setting a homicide inquiry into motion, he then just disappears for an hour, which is bizarre behavior, isn't it? He displayed in those moments a complete neglect of duty because subsequently he failed to preserve the scene. That means that vital forensic evidence had potentially been lost. Also, his logbook for that night went missing. And he didn't fill in his pocketbook until 2 days later. And even then, it looked like it had been altered. So the police suspected that he was hiding something. They thought maybe he was trying to protect his brother. But he denied having seen either his brother or his wife on the night of the killings. And I guess on a psychological level, we could say, well, maybe walking into a scene where children, an elderly lady and a young woman had died was overwhelming and he'd just kind of gone into some weird zone. But it's very odd behaviour, particularly for a man who is in a position of seniority, because you would expect that no matter how gruesome, he would have been used to this kind of work in the job, seeing things that nobody else would choose to want to see. We get to the 4th of July 2000, this is a year after the killings, all this money's gone into it. So there's a huge pressure on the police. They want to identify the suspect. They want to bring that suspect to justice. So at this point, Alison and her husband, Stephen, get arrested. They get arrested on suspicion of multiple murder. Stephen's brother, Stuart, he also gets arrested. So he gets charged with perverting the course of justice. Now, all three continued to strongly deny that they had anything to do with it. And it's scary because an angry mob, bear in mind, this is a really close community and 4 people have been murdered. It's riled people. They are angry. So this mob surrounds the police station once they've been arrested. They wanted blood, basically. And Alison said that she genuinely at that point believed that she was going to be killed, that there was no doubt whatsoever that all of those people were going to come in and kill her. So after 4 days of questioning, it's actually decided that there's insufficient evidence linking them to the crime. And so they get ruled out as suspects. That happens in January 2001. Stephen subsequently went on to sue South Wales Police for wrongful detention. And the solicitor he used was David Hutchinson. Now, this is the same solicitor who had represented Stephen and his brother after the arrest. But that is something that would later have catastrophic consequences for the murder trial. So, this happens. Obviously now, they've been released, no charges. Clearly, the general public probably have suspicions about them, innocent or otherwise, which is going to make it very difficult for them to get on with their lives. And this immense pressure to find the killer is continued. You know, it's not one of these cases where it's going to go away. Nobody can believe that this has occurred. These were children who were murdered and brutalised. Not just Mandy and her mother, children. They want to know, who is it in our midst who has carried out these killings? Because, of course, if that person isn't brought to justice, then they could strike again. The local community were literally shell-shocked, and they were shocked for a very long time about those brutal murders. There were demands for justice constantly. But the police, well, they were really struggling. They really struggled to find a suspect. You know, they'd ruled out the ones that they thought were potentially guilty, but then they get a break. And this break comes in February 2001. So an off-duty police officer, this is PC Debbie Powell, she ends up getting told by an acquaintance about an individual who allegedly was having sex with Mandy. So obviously Debbie Powell's ears prick up. Who's this person who potentially has had access to Mandy? And of course, if we're talking about a sexual relationship with Mandy, we already know that Mandy is having liaisons with other people. Well, that individual could be jealous, so they could be a suspect. And the person that they're talking about is 39-year-old father of two, David Morris. Now, he's better known as Di. He was a labourer. He was a former scrap metal dealer. Turns out he lived about a mile from Mandy's home. And believe me, if you want a perfect suspect, and you know you're struggling with this case, right? Because you want to make damn sure that somebody's going to go down, hopefully forever, for what they've done to this poor family. You want to make damn sure that that individual is not walking the streets, is not able to create this situation again for another poor family. And when you're looking at the background of people, and suddenly you hear about a person who firstly is meant to be sexually involved with the person who's been murdered, then secondly, their history, well, it's super dodgy, then you can't help but start thinking, well, this would make sense if this was the guy who was responsible. Now, his name also wasn't new to the investigation, so it had been mentioned in the weeks following the murders. So he'd given a statement, but he'd never at any point been considered a suspect. And the reason for that was he had a really strong alibi. However, he had a really big problem now, because the police wanted to know, why on earth didn't you disclose to us that you were in a sexual relationship with Mandy? At the end of the day, he had spoken to them, he'd given them a statement, but he'd failed to mention that he was being intimate with Mandy. And to add to this suspicion around him, a man who actually employed Morris, who he worked with in the building trade, he later confirmed that Morris had indeed told him that he'd had sex with Mandy on the 25th of June, 1999. That was 2 days before the murders. So now the police are really interested in this guy. And to add to that, like I said, you want a perfect background of somebody who fits this kind of bill, particularly when you're desperate to bring somebody to justice. Well, Morris had it. He was a notorious figure. Wherever he moved, he was known to be aggressive, he was known to be violent. He'd apparently learned to fight in Gendros. That's one of the toughest parts of Swansea. And he was getting into fights even when he was a little kid. At school, he was somebody who struggled. He struggled academically, and he left secondary school barely able to read and write, which, with respect, is a failure on the school's part, not just his part. I mean, no child should leave secondary school without being able to read and write. Obviously, it sets a precedent for the opportunities that they're going to have, or lack of, therefore. But it demonstrates that there was some dysfunction going on. And when he was a teenager, he started his criminality, had a criminal record for street fighting, for violence, ended up getting married in his late teens, and he had a daughter, but the marriage didn't last. So after his marriage breaks up, he ends up moving to Craigcefn Park. That's with his girlfriend, Mandy Jewell. And I'm going to be honest, he was feared in his local community. He wasn't one of those individuals you'd necessarily be inviting round to a barbecue, or, I don't know, knocking on and asking for some donations to charity. You'd get short, sharp shrift, shall we say, should you do that. So he was somebody that had a reputation, and actually the couple themselves, they ended up having a reputation for these public displays of absolute aggression, and clearly he was very domestically abusive because they fought with each other. I'm not saying that she didn't fight back, she did, but this was a very physical relationship, and he's the male in this situation, which means that he has the upper hand physically, but they are both very violent with each other. Police end up getting called to the flat constantly. Neighbours often witness Mandy Jewell being brutally beaten by Morris, and on one occasion, a resident actually saw him beating her around the head with a shovel. With a shovel. I mean, that could have killed her without a shadow of a doubt. So then this neighbour very bravely goes over and actually says to Morris, begs him, in fact, to stop doing this to his partner. And Morris turns to him and says, it'll be you next if you do not F off. Poor impulse control, lack of consequential understanding. I mean, the very fact that somebody has witnessed it would often be something that would stop an individual carrying on an attack, because obviously it means that the police could be called and there would be a witness. So, like I said, very poor at knowing how to manage his behaviour, and certainly high-level violence. So Morris is now, as far as the police are concerned, becoming a very, very prime suspect, because he's fitting all the characteristics that you'd expect to see historically, behaviour-wise, of somebody who's a high-level offender. And then they look at his criminal convictions, and he had almost two dozen previous convictions. This included a four-year jail term, that was in 1987, that was for robbery and conspiracy to rob, and it was very violent. He apparently threw an insurance company saleswoman across a car bonnet in the attack. So he's quite happy to lay his hands on females, isn't he? And again, poor consequential thinking there, isn't it? It just drives that understanding this is a man who's a violent perpetrator. He had convictions for burglary, theft, actual bodily harm. On one incident, he actually took a piece of wood and hit a victim on the head. This was during a street fight. So the police are thinking, wow, we have got the perfect suspect. First of all, intimately involved with one of the victims. Secondly, has a propensity for violence and a history of violence against women. So when you think about a pen portrait, this guy's fitting it. So Morris gets arrested. It's the 21st of March, 2001. He's brought in for questioning. He categorically denies any involvement in the murders. I say that, but it's not like many people go in and are like, it was totally me. I have got to admit it. Bang to rights. You just had to ask me. Should have asked me at the get-go. I'd have just said, yeah. But at the end of the day, he's like, no, I had nothing to do with this at all. He then gets asked if the gold neck chain that's found at the murder scene was his. He says, no, it wasn't. In fact, he swears on the lives of his children it was not his. Which, I know this is ridiculous to say, because, of course, people lie when they swear on the lives of the kids, but in my head, it's the one thing that would make me be like, I'm going to tell the truth, I can't swear on my kids' lives. Genuinely, the idea of doing that, I just think it tempts fate. But if you're a pathological liar, you'll just swear on anybody's life, won't you? Because you don't really care. But he says, no, absolutely not on my kids' lives. That gold chain has got absolutely nothing to do with me. But when they further investigate, it turns out that the paint on the gold chain that they found exactly matched the paint in his kitchen. Which I think we can agree is a little bit too much of a coincidence. You know, the idea that some gold chain that you might have been seen potentially wearing at some point in the past turns up in the property of an individual who's been murdered and happens to have flecks of paint from your kitchen on it is going to make it seem very, very dubious. So at this point, Morris finally says, OK, actually, on reflection, I'm going to be honest, the chain was in fact mine. At that point, I'd be like, well, I think you probably deserve to spend a few months in prison for swearing on your children's lives. I just have an issue with that as a mother. But that doesn't make him guilty, of course. But the police feel that because they've now got evidence that ties him to the murder scene, and also a big red flag for the police that he basically lied to them when asked about it, increases their suspicion. Now, Morris does have a reason for this. And to be fair, it makes sense. He says, you know what? I was at Mandy's flat, but I left that chain on the kitchen counter because I'd been to the property previously. I'd had sex with Mandy, and during sex, the clasp had broken, and I'd left it there. The problem that he has with that, which, as I've said, that would make sense. That'd be a reasonable excuse as to why your necklace was at the property. Like I said, a little bit dubious that you lie about it, but you may indeed be really scared about the potential of admitting that and getting tied to the crime that you hadn't committed. However, the problem with that is that witnesses said that they had indeed seen him wearing that chain in the pub on the night of the murders. And another issue that the police have with Morris is that he hasn't admitted this sexual relationship with Mandy to the police previously. And he says, well, I've got a simple explanation for that. I didn't want to tell my girlfriend that I'd been having a relationship with Mandy Jewell. I'd been in a relationship with her for 7 years. We lived together. I didn't want her to be aware that I betrayed her that way. So I hid it from you. His denial implicates him to some degree. So even though, with respect, there's a reasonable explanation there, isn't there? The fact that you wouldn't necessarily want your partner to know that you've been having it away with a murder victim. And if you can get away with not telling somebody about that, if the police don't need to be aware of it, then you're probably going to keep it to yourself. But clearly, for the police, this is a massive red flag. So I think at this point, we can all agree that the spotlight of suspicion is shining directly on Morris's head as far as the police are concerned. Then they look into his alibi. And then there's more suspicions because he claims that on the night of the murders, he's drinking at the New Inn in Clydach. Him and his girlfriend, Mandy Jewell, they'd had an argument. I know, shocking. Shocking that this couple had had an argument. Maybe she was questioning him about the fact that he was hitting her around the head with some kind of tool, which he'd done previously. One would imagine that she had a right to such kind of arguments. But he ends up leaving alone. And then he's just wandering the streets for hours. At some point during that period of time, he decides he's going to walk to his parents. His parents' home is like 8 miles away, but he thinks that's where he's going to go and stay. But then halfway to his parents, it starts to rain. So he's like, oh, it's raining now. I'm just going to walk home. Which kind of makes you go, just want to put it out there, Morris, but you were halfway there, so it would have taken you exactly the same amount of time to walk to your parents' house. Just throwing it out there, just saying. Anyway, he goes home instead, and he said he arrived home about 3 a.m, and his girlfriend then let him in. But his girlfriend, Mandy Jewell, well, she tells the police he'd actually arrived home between 10:30 p.m. and 11 p.m, and furthermore, she said, actually, I didn't let him in. So now it doesn't connect, it doesn't fit. This evidence is all mounting against him. So the investigators put together what they believe happened. They think that he's gone to Mandy's, he's intoxicated, he wants sex, and that basically she had spurned his advances, she'd rejected him because she'd begun this lesbian affair with Alison and therefore she no longer wanted to see him. The investigators also find out that Mandy had actually spoken to people about how scared she was of Morris. And you won't be surprised to know that apparently he'd been quite physically violent towards her. I mean, that is his history. That's his MO with women. So she had also been hurt by him. And witnesses at the pub they claimed that Morris had been bad-mouthing Mandy and that he'd even left in a rage on the night of the killings. So this is being told to the investigators and they are piecing this puzzle together and they feel that it is absolutely a picture of Morris that is being presented. Now, whilst Morris was now the prime suspect, there was actually no DNA evidence or fingerprints that linked him to the murder scene. And no witnesses had actually placed him there. The only real evidence that they had was the gold chain. Now that was, as I've said, found at the murder scene. It was caked in Mandy's blood. So that certainly had a connection with him. But the other thing is that Morris had a really fearsome reputation. So whilst the police weren't getting people coming forward saying, yeah, I saw him there, they feared that the reason for that was that people were terrified of what Morris would do if somebody spoke out about them. Although, arguably, you'd think if you're really scared of this guy and you had seen something, well, if you want him banged up for a long time at the end of the day, that would be a way to do it. So it may be that people were scared of him, or it may be that genuinely, absolutely nobody saw him anywhere near Mandy's that night. Now, it wasn't until nearly 2 years after the killings that Morris actually gets charged with the murder of Mandy and her family, and he pled not guilty to all counts. So we get to 2002, and that's the trial at Swansea Crown Court. And Morris's girlfriend, Mandy Jewell, she testifies in court. Bear in mind what she initially told the police. She said that he had arrived back around 10:30 p.m. on the night of the murders and that she'd not let him into the house. Now she's changed her story. She says that she didn't actually know what time he came back, but that she had let him in. So she admits that she'd originally lied to the police. Now she may have indeed lied to the police, or she might have just been terrified of Morris and agreed to change her story. Who knows? Both of those will have been potentials. But again, if she wanted him to be out of her life, a perfect opportunity would be to make it so that he went to prison. So arguably, would she make that up? But domestic abuse victims will often support their perpetrator because they're terrified of not doing. But as I said, I'm just making suggestions of possibilities. And the prosecution also put forward another potential reasoning behind it because they want to get the jury to think about all the possibilities that could have led to Morris making that decision. They say that Mandy has suddenly threatened to tell Morris's girlfriend that he'd been unfaithful and in retaliation for that, he'd killed her and all the witnesses. So Mandy's daughters and her mother. Now, I've got to tell you, even when they were in court, bear in mind the fact that when you're in court, you're in one of the safest places you could possibly be. There's lots of people, there's security, but people were terrified of Morris. So those key prosecution witnesses, they were so scared when they were giving evidence that they were apparently shaking as they testified against him. So no matter what anybody thinks of this case, what we do have to all agree is that Morris is a very terrifying individual. And also, we have to acknowledge that if you were a member of the jury and you're watching witnesses who look absolutely horrified and terrified because they're giving evidence against you, that's going to make you think, hang on, what kind of a character is this? And that can be a problem as well, because juries make decisions based on what their bias is a lot of the time. And in this case, Morris is, as far as they're concerned, provoking such a reaction in these individuals that they're probably thinking to themselves, this guy has to be guilty. Now, the defence, they have a completely different tack. Obviously, they're there to defend the individual that they are looking after, in this case, Morris. So they argue it's Mandy Powers' lesbian lover, Alison Lewis, who's killed her. And you can understand when you think about the prosecution putting forward their case, they're saying that he's killed Mandy in this psychotic rage. But remember what we said about the crime scene earlier on, none of the blows landed anywhere apart from on the victims. So that doesn't have the level of chaos that psychosis would expect to involve. So the defence argued that apparently Alison Lewis has killed her because she's really jealous and she is domineering of Mandy. And she'd been unfaithful herself and was really angry at the same time with the fact that Mandy was having these casual relationships with men. So even though she's having a relationship with Mandy and going behind her husband's back, Mandy is being unfaithful to her with these other guys or making her feel less worthy because of it. They bring in the fact that Alison's very proficient in using blunt instruments as weapons because of her karate training. And that same kind of a weapon was used to kill Mandy and her family. And the defence also put forward a possibility that Alison's husband, Stephen, well, he could have carried out the killings. You know, he finds out about his wife having this affair with Mandy and is enraged. And they add to that to make it sound like a possibility that Alison and Stephen were one another's alibis for the night of the killings. So effectively, it was a case of two suspects backing each other up. Now, Morris, when he's questioned, he says, "The only thing I lied about was the gold chain. I didn't want you to know that that gold chain was mine because I didn't want my girlfriend to find out that I'd been unfaithful." He said that he had worn a gold chain on the night that Mandy was murdered, but it was a completely different gold chain to the one that was found at the scene of the crime. So that's why he says witnesses said that he was wearing a gold chain. He just had another one. So again, he sticks to that story that he told the police when eventually they realised that gold chain did belong to him. And he says it was because I had sex with her, it got broken, it was left there. But the prosecution said, no, that didn't happen. You didn't even have sex with Mandy that night. And the reason that you didn't is because she was in an intimate relationship with Alison. So they claim that Morris only knew Mandy through her friendship with his girlfriend. So they try to get the jury to think, no, there was no consensual relationship here. She was with Alison. She was having a relationship with her. There was just a friendship between Morris's girlfriend and Mandy. The prosecution say, look, the only reason that gold chain was in situ the night of those murders was because it was torn from his neck during the killings. During the trial, when all of this prosecution defence is going on, the jury are having to witness some of the most traumatic pictures. The evidence that they're seeing is absolutely dreadful. And it was so traumatic that every single one of the jury members involved in that case, they were absolutely excused from jury service for the rest of their lives. That's how terrible the footage was. Because they even saw a video of the murder scene and it just showed this graphic injuries that the victims sustained. Remember, bear in mind, two of them were little girls. And it was so traumatizing that one young male juror passed out and he couldn't continue. Another went on to have a heart attack. Genuinely, that's how traumatizing the material was. It gets to the 28th of June 2002, virtually 3 years to the day, in fact, of the killings. There's this 11-week trial, so it goes on for a long time, and Morris is found unanimously guilty on all counts. He gets sentenced to life with a minimum term of 35 years. So now, as far as the police are concerned, they've definitely got that guy, and he's going to spend maybe the rest of his natural life in prison. After the trial, Alison and Stephen Lewis, they actually separate, and Alison's granted custody of their twin daughters. So there's a lot of dysfunction and trauma that plays out because of this trial. Morris, meanwhile, is in prison and constantly says he's innocent. He doesn't accept responsibility, he doesn't show remorse, he just says, I had nothing to do with this. So in October 2004, he gets leave to appeal his conviction. And they actually successfully argued that there'd been a conflict of interest at the first trial. So his solicitor, David Hutchinson, remember that name? He had actually represented Alison's husband, Stephen Lewis, and his brother following their arrest during the investigation. Now, this is a complete conflict of interest, as they themselves have been suspects in the case. So then the conviction gets quashed and a retrial gets ordered. And again, imagine that. It's very traumatizing, isn't it? For people who are from Mandy's family, and it's incredibly traumatizing again for the new jury who have to look at this evidence. So in 2006, the retrial actually takes place at Newport Crown Court. Prosecution rely on exactly the same evidence from the original trial. They don't move away from that. They tell the same story. Get to August 2006.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
Jury finds Maurice guilty of 4 counts of murder for a second time. So again, ultimately, they've listened to the evidence and they believe that he is the murderer. This time, though, he gets sentenced to a full life term. So not just over 30 years with the possibility of parole, just his natural life in prison. But that whole life term actually does not stick. So in 2007, it's quashed by the Court of Appeal. The statute dictated that the sentence following the retrial could not be harsher than the original sentence. So the life term is therefore replaced with the minimum term of 32 years. But Morris does not go quietly. He continually claims his innocence. He says, I did not do this. We get to 2018, and Morris's application to take his case to the Court of Appeal gets rejected by the Criminal Cases Review Commission. But then we get to 2020, and there's been a campaign for Morris's release simmering anyway. It's been going on and on and on, and it gets really bolstered because BBC Wales Investigates speaks to potential witnesses who were not called to give evidence at the original trials. And one of those was a taxi driver, and he stated on the night of the murders, he was driving down a road close to the murder scene between 2 a.m. and 2:30 a.m. He noticed two men walking along the pavement. And he said they looked really similar. That's why he noticed them. And they both got dark, cropped hair. So as soon as he hears about the murders that have happened that next day, he calls the police. Gets told somebody will get back in touch. Nobody called him back. And this really annoys him because he feels like he's got vital evidence. Then 2 weeks later, he actually calls the police again and he says, I can do better than that now. I can do better than tell you that I've seen two similar guys around the scene of the crime on the night of the murders. I can identify them. They were Stephen and Stuart Lewis. He'd seen pictures in the press and he was 100% convinced it was them. However, he was never even called to give evidence at either trial. Then another woman, Nicola Williams, she also thought that she saw Stephen Lewis near the murder scene on the night of the killings. This is around 2:30 a.m. Apparently he was wearing a bomber jacket and he was carrying a rolled up bundle under his arm. She later provides police with an e-fit and 15 months later picks him out of a video identity parade. And let me tell you, the e-fit did bear a striking resemblance to Stephen. In fact, he looked even more like his brother Stuart, who, although on duty, had, as we know, failed to adequately account for his whereabouts at the time of the murders. However, her account gets dismissed at court, and the judge told the jury to disregard it as Stephen had an alibi, despite the fact that this alibi was provided by his wife, who had also been a suspect. So, kind of strange. Then another man, this is a guy called John Allen, he claims to have seen a man who was wearing a bomber jacket and who was also carrying a bundle around 4 a.m. But the thing about him is he didn't actually come forward at the time of the murders. But bear in mind, not everyone does come forward at times of murders. Very often, memories are jogged when people do crime reconstructions or people do campaigning and then suddenly it sparks somebody's memory. So BBC Wales Investigates also went and consulted experts. They consulted experts who had been involved in the original investigation, and quite a lot of them were very sceptical about Morris's guilt. because of the accepted timeline. Now, it is hard to establish who was killed first. When they look at what played out, some theorise that the killer was actually waiting for Mandy and her daughters when they arrived home from babysitting for Mandy's cousin at 11:48 p.m. So they believe it was likely Mandy's mother, Doris, who died first, because the murder weapon, it had traces of Mandy's blood in it and also that of her daughter's, but not Doris's. So that suggests it was actually removed during the attacks that followed. During the attack on Doris, the light bulb was actually smashed. And that meant that upstairs, the lights would have fused and gone out. So the belief is that the killer actually took a chair from the children's bedroom and used it to reach the fuse box downstairs and then switched the lights back on. And then they wait for Mandy and the daughters to return. Now, if that sequence of events is correct, then the timeline suggests that Morris could not have been the killer, because witnesses said he left the pub at 10:30 p.m. It was a 15-minute walk to Mandy's house, and that would have meant he only had 3 minutes to kill Doris and to change the fuse. So that wouldn't make sense. Now, Morris fully admitted that on the night of the killings, he had drunk 8 pints in the pub that night. But remember, the prosecution had also said that he'd been injecting these really powerful amphetamines into his system. However, with respect, it does seem unlikely that someone who was so intoxicated could have done what the killer did after the murders. So, wash Mandy's body, etc. It's not necessarily in line with somebody who's massively inebriated. And again, as I've noted before, the victims have been struck with a high degree of accuracy. Like, if you're really drunk, could you do that? I mean, think about it. That's like people crash the cars. When they're highly intoxicated, they're not able to deal with things diligently. It makes you sloppy in your behaviour. So how did he do it so accurately? It gets to July 2021. This is after they review fresh evidence. The Crown Prosecution Service say no new information had come to light to undermine Morris's conviction, which is a little bit strange on the basis that I've just evidenced the new evidence that came to light that was literally on the news because it was investigated. But that's what the CPS say. No new information's come to light. Still absolutely sound, the conviction. And then it gets to 2021, 20th of August. This is after Morris has served 22 years of that sentence. He dies. He's 59, just collapsed outside his cell. When they did the post-mortem, they actually couldn't establish a cause of death. So no one knows actually what killed him. And throughout that sentence, he has never expressed any remorse for the killings. And till the day he dropped dead, he continued to say that he was an innocent man. And during those entire 22 years, as he maintained his innocence and refused to acknowledge his guilt, it meant that he never got more than the minimum of privileges during his time. Because part of the prison system is that you can build up certain privileges based on whether you acknowledge your guilt, whether you work through it, whether you attend education and so on and so forth, that says I'm reforming, I recognise what I've done as a crime, I'm paying for it, and hopefully in the future I'll be reformed because of it. He never ever gets further than minimum privileges because he just blank refuses to accept responsibility. Also, if Morris was still alive today, he would fully know that if he didn't admit his guilt, then he would never get out because the parole board wouldn't think he was safe. Because if they believed this guy bludgeoned to death an entire family, 2 children included, he'd never shown any remorse, apologised for his actions, and just constantly said he was innocent all the way through, therefore not accepting culpability, how could they release him? They wouldn't believe that he'd accepted the crime and that he'd made good on reforming. So he knew that he would not have been granted parole after serving the minimum 32 years. So many have said, look, that's evidence enough that he was innocent, because Morris would have sooner spent his entire life in prison than admit to offences he wasn't guilty of. When he died, hundreds of people lined the streets in Swansea and gathered outside the chapel for his funeral. They really believed that he was an innocent man, and they all came out to demonstrate the support for him. And it's an interesting one, that, isn't it? Because, look, Morris was not a nice guy. Look what he did to his girlfriend. He beat her horribly. He was violent in his past. He carried out terrible crimes against people. But that doesn't mean that he should be inside for a crime that he didn't commit. So people feel very moved by that. And like I said, hundreds of people came out in support. Now, last year, Morris's representatives requested a forensic review of the evidence. So his family had actually allowed for a blood sample to be taken from him after his death. At this point, the police appointed an independent senior investigating officer and a forensic laboratory to carry out this review. Bear in mind, I mean, DNA profiling has had massive advances in the last 22 years, and they really hoped that by taking this blood sample, sending it off, it was going to be more evidence that could be brought to light. And when they do it, they find a DNA profile that's on the bloodstained sock that's found at the crime scene. The sock that police believe the attacker had worn on the hand when carrying out the attacks. Now, that DNA profile that linked Morris, or a male relative on his paternal side, to the crime scene. Now, whilst it couldn't actually confirm how his DNA got onto a sock, as far as they were concerned, that was more evidence pointing to his guilt. But in spite of that, lots of people refused to accept that Morris was guilty as charged. Many, many, many people believe it's a massive miscarriage of justice, and actually they believe it's a case of police corruption. So they alleged that the South Wales police wanted to protect their own. As far as they were concerned, they were looking after police officers who, as far as they were concerned, they didn't want to out as being the guilty parties. They say that Stephen and Alison Lewis were the more likely suspects because they had more of a solid motive to kill. They say that, as far as they're concerned, Morris was just the perfect scapegoat. You know, he had a violent past, he's in sexual relationship with one of the victims, and a lot of people believe that what the police did was they just built a case around Morris, and then they made the evidence fit the suspect. It's actually been argued that South Wales police should have handed the investigation over to another force right at the start, and that would make perfect sense because, come on, two of their serving officers and a former officer were initially suspects. There's a massive conflict of interest there, aren't there? Because you literally have relationships with other police officers who are investigating the case, and they might be your mates. They're going to be hoping to God it's not you. And if they can find somebody else that they can fit up for it and make themselves believe even that that individual is guilty, then that's going to work massively in your favour. So a lot of people genuinely believe there's been this huge miscarriage of justice. But that's also meant that the spotlight has to some degree gone back on the individuals who were first looked at for this crime. And Stuart Lewis, who was initially charged with perverting the course of justice, he recently said that because of his family's involvement in the murder inquiry, that their whole lives had been ruined. So at the time, he was remanded in custody for 4 days. He was interviewed on 26 occasions, and he was then suspended for 4 years. So he then loses his career, leaves the police force, and then struggles to find work. He said, you know, the internet is one of those things that people will just Google your name, and I'm linked to the Clydach murders. And he said that as a family, they still receive abuse from people who genuinely believe that they were responsible for the killings. He said, it's too late to fully exonerate my name. The damage has been done. The negative impact on myself and my family over the last 22 years has been severe and long-lasting. Many will still believe there is no smoke without fire. And you can understand what he's saying there, because the BBC clearly did this investigative piece And the consequence of that investigative piece was that lots of people who didn't necessarily know a lot about the case now feel that they do know about the case. And that has, again, shone the spotlight on their family. And Alison, well, she's suffered a lot of abuse as well since the killings. And she recently said this, 22 years later, I am still sat here defending myself, telling people that I'm not a murderer when all I wanted to do was love her. Mandy was always kind, loving. She tried to do her best all the time and enjoyed her life and the children. She had so much to give and so much to live for. There hasn't been a day when I haven't missed her. I loved being with her and everything about her made me happy. I had hoped that by the end of my research, I would have an idea as to whether I believe Morris is guilty or innocent, whether they got it wrong or right, but I still remain quite confused. But I do know one truth. I know that the true victims in all of this are Mandy, her mother, and her young daughters, along with all of the surviving relatives who can genuinely never have any form of closure on this tragedy because of all the ongoing speculation. And it must haunt them a little bit, the idea that there is this possibility that maybe the wrong person did go down for murder, which means that the true killer is still walking free potentially today. Let me know your thoughts. I know you've got really strong feelings on this case. I appreciate that maybe you would have liked me to come down on one side, point guilt at one party or another. But the truth is, from my experience of reading all the research and looking at all the evidence that I could get my hands on, I don't know. I don't know whether Morris did kill them. I think it's quite flimsy evidence. I think it's really strange that they didn't bring in the witnesses that clearly had a different story to tell. And the timelines, even with the experts who initially investigated it, seem questionable when you put that together. And no matter what a horrible human being Morris had been in the past, he certainly didn't deserve to go down and spend the rest of his natural life in prison if that were the case. That's it for Bang to Rights today. Join me for the next episode. See you then. Be safe.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen, brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
L-E-T-E-N-P-C. Your night in just got legendary. Get ready to chase the rush. Spin, win, and redeem instantly straight to your bank account at legendswithaz.com. With free-to-play slots, blackjack, keno, roulette, and more, experience all the thrills of Vegas without leaving your couch. Legends has it all.
Legends is a free-to-play social casino. Okay. Void where prohibited. Must be 18 plus. Play responsibly. Visit legends.com for full details.
Get in the game now and score a 50% bonus on your first purchase only at legendswithaz.com.
Shop the Sherwin-Williams Super Sale and get 40% off paints and stains August 8th through the 14th. With prices starting at $29.39, it's the perfect time to transform your space with color. Whether you're looking to revamp your interior or exterior, we have you covered with bold hues, soothing neutrals, and everything in between. Visit your neighborhood Sherwin-Williams store or shop the sale online. Delivery available on qualifying orders. Click the banner to learn more. Retail sales only. Some exclusions apply. See store for details.